I don't want you to think I'm weird or anything. Bernard Pine turned around to the file cabinet. He fumbled for a key, unlocked it, opened the bottom drawer. He reached into the back and pulled out a magazine in protective wrap. The magazine was called Sports Globe. The publication date was from 2 decades ago. On the cover was a swimsuit model. There was a yellow post-it marking a page. Pine carefully turned to it. "Pia," he said, with a longing that made even Wilde pull up. "Gorgeous, right?" Wilde looked down at the model in the floss bikini. "This was taken a year after we met. Pia mostly modeled lingerie and bikinis. She tried out for Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Huh. You remember how big that used to be?" Wilde said nothing. "So Pia goes on an audition, or whatever they call it, and you know what Sports Illustrated tells her?" He stopped and waited for Wilde to answer. To keep things moving, Wilde said, "No. They said she's too curvy." That's the word they used, curvy. "They thought her..." He cupped his hands in front of his chest. "It had to be fake. Can you believe that? They said they were so great, they had to be implants." He gestured toward the photograph. "But those are real." "Amazing, right?" Wilde said nothing. "I sound like a pig, don't I?" Wilde chose the lie that would keep him talking. "Not really. Pia and I met at a club in the East Village. Oh, I couldn't believe my luck. I mean, every guy wanted her. We just hit it off. She was so beautiful. I couldn't stop staring at her. We fell pretty hard. I was working at Smith Barney back then, making pretty sweet dollars. Pia was modeling just enough. I'm not saying it was perfect. Beautiful women, women who look like this, they always have a little crazy. Comes with the package, I guess, but back then I found that so exciting, you know, and she was just so super hot. We were in love. We had money. We had the city. We had no responsibilities." Bernard closed the magazine with care, as though it were a fragile religious text, and slipped it back into the protective plastic. He turned back to the file cabinet, placed it in the back, locked the drawer. "We were together about a year when Pia told me that she couldn't have children. This will sound weird, I guess, but we never talked about it before. I don't know, I guess she worried about my reaction, but, and this might surprise you, I was thrilled. We were having a blast. I didn't want a baby messing it up, and, man, this will sound awful. I loved her bod so much. I had friends with hot wives. Not hot like Pia, but hot. And after childbirth, well, you know what I'm saying?" Wilde said, "Uh-huh." "I'm just being honest." Wilde said, "Uh-huh," again. "So we got married. Big mistake. Pia and me, we were good before we made it official. And then you start hanging around other married couples, and they're all having babies. Pia, well, what I thought was her being eccentric and maybe a little moody, now that's more like depression or bipolar or something like that. She started staying in bed all day. She didn't take any more jobs. She even put on a few pounds." Wilde wanted to feign a gasp and say how awful, but he stayed silent. "So now, of course, Pia wants a baby. I don't know if it's the best thing, but I love her. I want her happy. And we wouldn't be the first people to think a baby could save our marriage, right? So we start talking about surrogates and all that. But in the end, I find this adoption agency in Maine. You pay a little more, but they make things smoother. The agency told us we would have a healthy baby in 6 months. Pia, well, it worked. She heard that news, she started taking care of herself again. We were back, except, you know, she became obsessed with the arrival. Suddenly, she didn't want to live in the city anymore. The city was dirty, she said. It's no place to raise a child, so she found this place." Bernard spread his hands. "In the real estate section of the Times, you know, like Unusual Homes. So we bought it and moved out here 2 days before Naomi came home to us. It was all going to be great. Bernard Pine stopped. So what happened? Wilde asked. I read somewhere that even adoptive mothers can suffer from postpartum depression or something similar. I don't know if that's what it was, but Pia kind of lost herself. Huh. It was awful. She couldn't connect to her daughter in any way. Not even in, like, a cellular way. It was like our baby was a new kidney Pia's body was rejecting. Interesting way to put it, Wilde thought. So what did you do? I hired nannies. Pia kept firing them. I tried to get her to see a shrink, but she flat out refused. And I still had a job. The commute from out here to the city, no matter how you slice it, is at least an hour each way. He closed his eyes hard, then opened them. One day, I came home, and there was a bruise on Naomi's arm. She fell, Pia said. Another day, there was a cut over her eye. The girl is clumsy, Pia said. Bernard made a fist and put it near his mouth. This is very hard to talk about. You want a glass of water or something? No. I want to get through this before I chicken out. I've never told this story, not to anyone. I should have done more, I guess. I should have insisted Pia get help, or... He stopped again, exhausted, and for a moment Wilde feared that he wouldn't go on. We've come this far, Wilde said. Tell me the rest. I started to get scared for Naomi's health. So one day, I didn't go to work. I just pretended like I was heading to the bus, but I hung in town. I can't say exactly why. Something felt extra off that morning. Or maybe I had a premonition, I don't know. I came home an hour after I left, totally unexpected. I could hear the screaming from the driveway, both of them, screaming. I ran inside. They were upstairs. Pia was giving her a bath. The water. It was so hot. I could see the steam coming up off the top. He squeezed his eyes shut now. That was it. The straw that broke the camel's back. I forced Pia to get help, though help is a relative term. We got divorced, quietly. No reason to let the world know what happened, right? Pia gave up all parental rights, buying my silence, maybe. Or maybe she just knew that she'd never care. That was 15 years ago. Naomi hasn't seen her mother since. Wilde tried to wade past what he'd just heard, tried to get past this horrible tale, and kept moving ahead with his investigation. Then, are you sure? What do you mean? Could Naomi and your ex have started seeing each other behind your back? Ugh, I don't think so. Pia still battles with severe mental health issues, but she's managed to lasso in a rich new husband. My guess? She stopped thinking about Naomi long ago. Chapter 26. Hester called Aaron Gerios, a former FBI special agent who'd worked hostage situations and kidnappings.
I have a hypothetical situation for you.
A hypothetical, Gerios repeated.
Yes,
Hester said.
You know what the word hypothetical means, don't you, Aaron?
When you call, it means the situation is real, not hypothetical,
but you can't tell me who it is. I'll pretend you said that in a hypothetical way.
Hester laid out the kidnapping ransom situation. The suggestions Aaron made were pretty close to what Wilde had already set up. In short, they were doing everything right, considering the circumstances. Gerios also questioned the likelihood that this was a legitimate kidnapping. It sounds more like this kid is pranking his parents.
Could be.
Or some hot girl seduced him into doing this.
A man thinking with his dick first, Hester said. I didn't know such a thing existed.
You've always been a naive waif, Hester.
Yes, yes, true. Thanks, Aaron.
No worries. But may I offer you one last piece of repetitive advice?
Sure. Convince your hypothetical parents to contact the very real FBI. Even if it's a big nothing, these situations tend to go sideways when we aren't involved. Aaron hung up. Hester was still walking the grounds of Maynard Manor. There was little doubt that the estate was grand in the old school way in which it was intended to be, but some of the modern touches were jarring. Right now, Hester was walking past a sculpture garden with somewhat tacky bronze likenesses of the Maynard family from several years ago. The twin girls, who were now 14, Hester couldn't remember their names, something with K's like Katie or Karen, looked to be about 7 or 8 in the bronze. One flew a bronze kite, while the other kicked a bronze ball. Bronze Crash was probably around 12 or 13 and carried a lacrosse stick on his shoulder like Huck Finn with a fishing pole. Bronze Delia and Bronze Dash watched their bronze children and laughed. The entire bronze Maynard family were laughing, their faces frozen in that laugh forever and ever, and that was kind of creepy. Hester's phone buzzed. The caller ID said Orin. Despite everything, her cheeks still flushed just seeing his name.
Articulate, Hester said.
Why do you answer the phone that way?
Long story.
Can I hear it sometime in the very near future? She smiled.
How near?
I'm on backup duty tonight, so I have to stay in the area. What's your schedule look like?
I'm in town,
visiting Matthew and Layla.
Something else, Hester said. Business.
Oh. Are you free for dinner, then? It won't quite be last night, but I'm powerful enough to get us a table at Tony's Pizza and Sub. I'll even pay.
Thank you for that, by the way.
For what?
For letting me pay last night. For thanking me and not playing the macho card and insisting.
I was trying to be a modern, sensitive man. How did I do?
Very well.
I never understood that, really.
What?
This will sound too politically correct.
Go on.
Well, let's face it. You make a lot more money than I do. I'm not being all evolved here, just the opposite. But I never get the guys who get all bent out of shape when the woman makes more money. The way I've always looked at it, if I'm lucky enough to be with a highly successful woman, that makes me look better. The more successful my girl is, the more I look good. Makes sense?
He said, my girl. Swoon.
So, Hester said, your being so evolved is really being self-involved?
Exactly.
Hester realized again that she was smiling in a way she normally never smiled.
I like it.
That said, I got tonight's check, which will be less than the tip on last night's dinner. 7-ish, unless you're heading back into the city tonight. Hester thought about it. She didn't know what the status of this would be, but either way, she would need to stick around, and she would probably need to eat. They made the plans tentative, and then they hung up. Hester wandered back toward the house. The grounds were immense and held no appeal to Hester. The constant tranquility grew unnerving. Hester headed inside and found Delia on the phone in that library that was a little too Disney-esque. Delia spotted Hester and waved her in. She put a finger to her lips to signal silence and hit the button for the speakerphone so Hester could listen, too. Delia said,
"Thanks, Sutton, for getting back to me. I would have called back sooner, Mrs. Maynard, but I was in class."
The girl sounded very much like a teenager.
"Is Crash okay?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Well, he's not in school today."
"When did you last talk to him?"
"Crash? We texted last night."
"What time, Sutton?" Delia asked. There was a hesitation. "He's not in any trouble," Delia said, "but he went out last night, and I haven't heard from him today."
"Can you hold on a second?" Sutton asked. "I can look up exactly on my phone."
"Sure." There was a short delay, and then Sutton said, 1:48 a.m. "What did he say?"
"He just said he had to go."
"That's it?"
"Yeah, gotta run. That was it."
"Do you have any idea where he might be?"
"No, sorry. I'm sure it's nothing. I can check with Trevor and Ryan and the guys."
"That would be great, thanks."
"The only thing is," Sutton began.
"Yes?"
"I mean, I don't want you to worry or anything, but He usually texts me a lot. I mean, we all do. We have group chats and just regular texts and Snapchat and whatever else. I mean, I can't remember the last time he didn't text me in the morning. Delia put a hand to her neck. Did you text him?
Just once.
No reply.
You want me to try again?
Yes, please.
I'll let you know if I hear anything.
Delia looked over at Hester. Hester mouthed the word Naomi at her. Delia nodded. Is Crash friendly with Naomi Pine? Silence.
Sutton. Why would you ask about Naomi?
Delia looked over at Hester. Hester shrugged.
Well, Naomi is missing.
And you think Crash is with her?
The disbelief in her voice was palpable.
I don't know. I'm just asking. Are they friends?
No, Mrs. Maynard. I don't want to be mean, but Naomi and Crash travel in very different circles.
And yet he encouraged her to play that challenge game, right?
I have to go to class. If I hear from Crash, I'll let you know right away.
Sutton hung up. Hester said,
Is that Crash's girlfriend?
On and off. Sutton is probably the most popular girl in the school.
And Crash is one of the most popular boys, Hester said.
Yes.
So maybe the popular boy suddenly has a thing for the ostracized girl.
Sounds like a bad teen rom-com, Delia said with a shrug. Then again, it wouldn't be the first time.
Maybe even his bullying her.
My son didn't bully her,
or whatever you want to call it. Maybe it was like that little boy in the playground who pulls the girl's pigtails because he likes her.
Delia didn't like that.
That little boy usually grows up to be a sociopath.
What's on those tapes, Delia?
The change of subject caught Delia Maynard off guard. That was the purpose, of course. Hester was studying her face, looking for the tell. She thought she saw one. Not 100% sure. Hester had been questioning people for a very long time. More than most, she could see a lie. But those who claimed to be foolproof were, to quote half of the word, usually the fools.
There's nothing important, Delia said.
Then contact the FBI.
We can't.
Which suggests that you have something to hide. Sorry, I'm not great with subtle, so let me get right to it. I think you're lying. Worse, you're lying to me. So let me make this clear. I don't care what you're hiding or what's on those tapes. If I know about it and I'm your attorney, it stays secret.
Delia smiled, but there was no humor in it.
Always?
Always.
No matter what?
No matter what.
Delia crossed the room and looked out the window. The view was spectacular, but it didn't seem to be bringing Delia Maynard much peace or comfort or joy.
I told you I watched your show the other night when Saul Strauss was on.
What about it?
Strauss started to raise the if-you-could-have-stopped-Hitler speculation. You cut him off.
Of course I did, Hester said. It's utter nonsense on a thousand levels.
So, let's say, hypothetically, I knew something that could have stopped Hitler.
Oh, please.
And I confide it to you under attorney-client privilege.
Would I tell? Hester said.
No. Even if it means letting Hitler rise to power?
Yes, but it's a dumb hypothetical, Hester said. I don't want to get too deep into this. But have you read much on the Hitler paradox? In short, if you went back in time and killed baby Hitler, the changes may be so massive that everything would change. Almost every birth thereafter. And so you and I wouldn't be here. But that's not why this is dumb. It's dumb because I can't read the future or go back in time. The future is all conjecture. None of us have a clue what it will be like. So I can tell you that whatever your grave secret is, I won't tell, no matter what. Because I don't know if it will really stop the next Hitler. I also don't know if stopping the next Hitler is even desirable. Maybe if I stopped Hitler, a more competent psycho would have risen instead after those German scientists developed a nuclear bomb. Maybe it would have gone even worse. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do, Delia said. There are too many variables. You may think you're stopping a slaughter and end up creating a bigger one.
Exactly. I've heard some horrible confessions in this job. Gruesome. Terrible.
Hester closed her eyes for a moment.
And maybe the world would have been better if I broke my oath, but only on a micro level. Justice for that family, maybe. Preventing another tragedy, and even worse, but in the end, I have to believe in the system, flawed though it may be.
Delia nodded slowly. There's nothing on those tapes.
You're sure I am?
There are some things Rusty's enemies may try to use against him, but there is no smoking gun.
Okay, then, Hester said.
Her phone buzzed. She saw a text from Wilde. My security people will be there within the half hour. Delia was about to make another call. Hester watched her for a moment. Delia felt the eyes on her and looked up.
What?
Delia said.
Let me add one more caveat to the above, Hester said. Mother to mother.
Okay.
If it meant saving my son, I'd talk.
Delia didn't move.
I'd scream. I'd shout. I'd reveal everything. That's where all our paradox theories would go out the window. If I could go back in time, if I could reveal a truth, and it would bring my son back to me, I'd do it in a heartbeat. Do you understand?
I think so. Hester's eyes stayed dry as she nodded and turned away. Chapter 27. The team from Wilde's old security firm pulled up in two vehicles. The first car was a forest green Honda Odyssey minivan. The driver was Rolla Nacer, the firm's founder. When Rolla opened the car door, Wilde could hear her kids screeching from the back seat. The radio was blasting out a Wiggles tune about fruit salad being yummy.
Mommy will be right back, Rolla said.
Neither the screeching nor the music paused for that announcement. Rolla got out of the minivan and started toward Wilde. Her blue blazer had a stain on the lapel. She wore Puma sneakers and mom jeans. A diaper bag of some sort was slung over her shoulder. She stomped toward him, head high. Rolla was barely 5 feet tall, so she had to look up to meet his eye. Wilde braced himself.
Are you kidding me, Wilde?
What?
What?
Rolla said, doing a pretty good, pretty sarcastic impression of him.
Don't even with that, okay?
Sorry.
I deserve better from you, do I not?
You do, yes.
So how long has it been? Rolla asked.
I don't know, he said.
Yes, you do. 2 years. 2 frigging years, Wilde. Last time I saw you was when Emma was born.
Emma was Rolla's 5th child. 3 boys, 2 girls, all under the age of 12. Years ago, Rolla had been his foster sister at the Brewer's house. Over the years, the Brewer family had almost 40 foster kids go through their lives, and all had been made better by the experience. Some stayed only a few months. Some, like Wilde and Rolla, stayed years.
And this stain you keep staring at? She pointed to her lapel. The one I know you are dying to clean off me? That's Emma's spit-up, thank you very much. What do you have to say to that?
Gross? She shook her head. Rolla's background, like his, was something of a mystery. Her mother was a Sunni Arab who fled the Kingdom of Jordan, arriving in the United States pregnant and unmarried. She'd cut off all ties to family and friends from her native country. She never spoke of them. She never told anyone, not even Rolla, who her father was.
What the hell, Wilde? 2 years.
Sorry, Wilde said again. He looked toward the minivan. How is everyone? Rolla arched an eyebrow.
For real?
What?
How is everyone? Rolla repeated, doing the impression again. That's the best you can do?
You don't visit? You don't call?
I called, he said.
When?
Today. Just now.
Rolla's mouth dropped open.
Are you for real right now?
He said nothing.
You called because you needed help.
Still a call, he said. Rolla shook her head and said with deep regret in her voice,
Wilde, you'll never change, will you?
He had warned Rolla when she'd insisted he be her full-time partner, that there was no way he could last. She knew, and even understood, but Rolla had always been the craziest sort of rah-rah optimist, even when she had no right to be. In the brewer house, Rolla had been outgoing and boisterous and engaged and social and never stopped talking. She loved the frenzy of activity, the shuffling of foster kids in and out, in part, Wild thought, because she hated being alone. Rolla craved a crowd the way Wild craved solitude. More than overcoming the obstacles, Rolla had excelled. Valedictorian of her high school class, vice president of the class, captain of her soccer team on every level. As a college standout athlete, she'd been heavily recruited by the FBI. She joined, rose up the ranks quickly, and then when Wild came home from the army, she somehow convinced him to open a private investigation firm with her. She had decided to call it CRAW, Chloe, Rolla, and Wild. Chloe, now deceased, had been the brewer's dog. CRAW, Rolla said at the time. The name is cute, right? Adorable. Wild had tried to hang on and fit in and go to the office, but in the end, he couldn't stick it out. It wasn't his way. He tried to give her back his shares, but Rolla wouldn't take them. She still wanted his name on the door, so every once in a while, he did some extracurricular work for her. He knew that he should be better about communicating, return calls, be more present, reach out every once in a while, say yes to a social engagement. And he did care about Rolla and Scott and their kids. He cared a lot. But he couldn't do more. It just wasn't in him. I brought everything, Rolla said, transitioning quickly into serious work mode. She shrugged the bag off her shoulders and handed it to him. He frowned. Is this a diaper bag? Don't worry, it's brand new, no germs. If someone opens it, they'll just find clean baby clothes and clean diapers. You can tell them you're a caring uncle, though that will obviously be a big character stretch. Do you need me to show you where the hidden pockets are? I think I'll figure it out. I packed 4 GPS trackers, 3 throwaway phones. You need a blade? No. And there's still one in the snap flap closure, where I keep the wipes. Terrific. Wild looked at the other car. It was a black Buick. I need 3 people to cover the Maynards at all times. 3 of our best are in the Buick, Rolla said. She nodded. The car doors opened, and her security team stepped out. All women, Wild said. That a problem? Nope. You're so progressive, Wild. And the flaming redhead on the right isn't a woman. Zelda is gender non-binary. Zelda gave him a little wave. Wild waved back. The 4 of us will rotate shifts, Rolla said. Wait, you?
Yes, me.
I'll be in the first group.
You can't bring your kids to the Maynards.
Really, Wild? I didn't realize. Thanks for telling me. Can I just jot that down? Rolla mimed a pen in her hand and a pad in her palm. Don't bring kids to a kidnapping. She put away the air pen. There. All set.
Ah, Rolla, now mimicking her. You'll never change, will you?
That made her smile. Wild looked back over at the Honda Odyssey.
So, who's in your car?
Emma and the twins. The twins, he remembered, were 6. I'm dropping Zoe and Elijah at a friend's birthday in Upper Saddle River at a place called the Gravity Vault. One of the moms said she'd watch Emma until Scott gets there. I'll be at the Maynards within the half hour.
Okay.
Anything I should know?
You know the drill.
Rolla gave him a mock salute.
Right.
For a second, the two of them stood there, unsure what to do.
I got to go, Wild said, awkwardly pointing behind him with his thumb. Then he spun away.
He didn't turn around, but he heard the black Buick peel away and Rolla calmly say, Zoe, let go of your brother's hair, as she climbed back into the minivan. 10 minutes later, Wild arrived at the 7-Eleven down the block from the high school. Ava had texted him that she would meet him here because the school itself, after yesterday's physical altercation with Thor Bryce, was off limits. Wild headed inside, watched the hot dogs circle, saw the Slurpee machines. Nothing changes at a 7-Eleven. Time flows forward everywhere, except in a 7-Eleven. As Ava O'Brien pulled into the parking lot, Wild felt his phone buzz. He checked the screen and saw it was Gavin Chambers.
Where are you? Gavin asked.
7-Eleven.
Are you serious?
I could snap a picture of a Slurpee as proof.
Wait there.
Why?
something you need to see. Don't move.
Chambers hung up. Ava came in and, without preamble, asked, what's so important? No hello, no greeting of any sort. Maybe Ava was upset about yesterday. She looked more harried today, though no less beautiful. Her eyes sparkled when they looked up at him. Following her lead, Wilde got to the point. Do you know Saul Strauss? Ava made a face. That activist on TV?
Yes.
I know who he is, sure. I mean, do you know him personally?
No, why?
You've never spoken to him or communicated with him in any way.
No, again, why?
Because he knew about my encounter with Crash at your school.
So did everyone else, Ava said.
We ended up out in the parking lot, remember? He knew more than that.
But I don't understand. Why are you asking me here?
I'm trying to figure out Saul Strauss's source. The sparkling eyes caught fire.
This is why you dragged me out of school during my free period? I'm not his source, Wilde. And why would someone like Saul Strauss care about any of this anyway?
Wilde said nothing. Ava looked annoyed. Hello? He didn't know how much to tell her. He believed her about not knowing Strauss, and even if she did, he couldn't follow the line of logic. Suppose Ava worked with Strauss somehow. Suppose Ava told Strauss that Wilde had confronted Crash about a missing teenage girl. So what follows? Strauss kidnaps the boy? Did that make any sense? Too many missing pieces.
Crash Maynard is missing, Wilde said.
That surprised her.
Wait, when you say missing, ran away, hiding, kidnapped, whatever. Last night he was home. Today, he's gone.
Ava took that in for a moment.
You mean like Naomi?
Yes. She took two steps toward the back, so that they were now standing by the chips and salty snacks. He didn't interrupt with a question, not yet. He wanted to give her some time.
That may explain some stuff, Ava said.
Like?
I thought Naomi was, I don't know, lying is too strong a word. Exaggerating is too mild.
Wilde waited. When she didn't say anything else, he asked, what about?
Crash?
What about him?
Naomi has been hinting lately that she had a secret boyfriend, someone super popular. I didn't take it seriously. Do you remember that old bit about the guy who says, oh, I have a hot girlfriend, but you wouldn't know her?
Wilde nodded. She lives in Canada or something.
Right.
You thought Naomi was making it up.
Or imagining it, whatever. Yeah, at first.
And then?
Then, after I pushed a little, she told me that the boy was Crash Maynard. She said the whole challenge game was a cover, and that Crash got jealous because she went into the woods with Matthew.
Matthew.
What did you say to that? Wilde asked.
I started wondering whether Crash was setting her up again, pretending to like her so he could ultimately humiliate her.
Yes, like in Carrie, or, wait, wasn't the boy who asked Carrie out in the movie nice? Didn't he try to defend her, but then the bullies poured pig's blood on her?
Wilde didn't remember.
So, you think maybe Crash does like her?
I don't know, Ava said, chewing on her lower lip.
But maybe the simplest answer is the best one. Naomi and Crash are together. Maybe they just want a few days alone. Maybe it isn't our business.
Something wasn't adding up. Or it was adding up too neatly.
I have to get back, Ava said.
Let me walk you to your car. They headed out to the parking lot. Ava hit the unlock button. He wanted to open the door for her, but that felt too faux chivalrous. When she got into the driver's seat, he signaled for her to lower the window for a moment. She did. Wilde leaned against the opening.
I also talked to Naomi's dad.
And?
He said Naomi's mother was abusive.
He filled her in on the details of his conversation with Bernard Pine. As Ava listened, her eyes glistened with tears.
Poor Naomi.
I knew the relationship hadn't been good, obviously, but that? Ava shook her head. I better go.
You'll be okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You want me to stop by your place later, he asked.
Words just came out.
Wilde hadn't planned them.
That wasn't like him.
Ava looked surprised, took another swipe at her eyes, and turned to him.
When?
I don't know. Tonight, maybe, tomorrow. We can just talk.
Ava looked out the front windshield rather than at him.
No pressure, Wilde added. I may not be free anyway, what with Crash and Naomi.
No, I'd like that. Ava reached through the open window and put her hand on his face. He waited. She looked as though she was about to say more, but in the end, she just took her hand away. She put the car in reverse, pulled out, and headed back toward the school.
Chapter 28. So, you got Arnie Poplin ready? Hester asked.
Hester stood facing the computer monitor in the Maynard's state-of-the-art studio office. The room was white and steel and looked more like something you'd find in a refurbished Manhattan loft rather than this old estate, but there it was. There were television screens lining the walls. Her producer, Alison Grant, was on the line. Rola Nacer, someone Hester had known for many years, was setting up the live feed. Hester had always liked Rola, admired her strength under adversity. When Rola and David were teens at the same high school, she'd even hoped that maybe her David would ask her out. She even pushed him a little, surprise, surprise. David never listened, of course, claiming that it would be weird because Rola was like Wilde's sister. What if he had? Would everything have changed? Would David still be alive?
Okay, he's connected in now, Allison said.
Hester shook away the ghosts and leaned toward Rola.
Did you hear that?
Got it, Rola said as she typed. Hester's idea was a simple, albeit an unreliable one. Saul Strauss said that his source on the Maynard tapes was Arnie Poplin. Arnie Poplin was, if nothing else, an attention whore. Hester got Allison to track him down with the promise of a pre-interview that could lead to a live segment. Rola said,
You see that monitor on the wall?
You mean that gigantic TV?
Yes, Hester, the gigantic TV.
I see it. I think he could see it from space.
Stand over there, Rola said. I'm going to patch Arnie Poplin through.
Stand where, exactly?
There's a spike on the floor.
And so there was. A spike was what studios or theaters called the mark, usually made with electrical tape, to tell you where to stand or where to place a piece of the set. Hester stood on it. Rola said, Ready?
As I'll ever be. Will Arnie be able to see you in the room?
No. His camera will be focused on your face only. It's why I chose that monitor.
Great.
Thanks, Hester smiled at her.
It's really good to see you, Rola.
And you, Hester.
Ready?
Hester nodded. Rola clicked a few more keys, and the screen came to life. Arnie Poplin's familiar, though more bloated, face filled the screen, huge and close up, too close up, see his skin pores close up. Hester was tempted to take a step back, but alas, the spike.
Hi, Arnie.
He scowled a little too theatrically.
What the hell is this, Hester?
They'd met over the years at one thing or another. 25 years ago, Arnie Poplin had starred in a hit family sitcom as the hilarious neighbor. For 3 years, he was beloved and famous. Then, poof, it was over. Like many, he ended up fighting the withdrawal pains from two of society's most potent addictions, drugs and fame. People underestimate the power of that bright, warm beacon known as fame, and how dark and cold it gets when that beacon goes out. So Arnie desperately tried to hang on. Allison Grant half-joked that Arnie Poplin would appear at the opening of a garage door. He tried to bow and scrape his way onto game shows, reality shows, home and garden shows, cooking shows, anything to turn on that beacon, less bright, less warm, even for a few seconds. Hester said,
I wanted to ask you,
you think I'm an idiot?
He was sweaty and red-faced.
I saw your Saul Strauss segment, Hester.
Do you know what you called me? A celebrity has been turned conspiracy nut, Hester said.
His mouth dropped open in what she assumed was mock surprise. It took him a few seconds to work up the bluster again. Actors.
You expect me to just forgive you for that?
You have two choices here, Arnie. You can disconnect this call or Skype or whatever this video cloudy thingy is, or you can tell me your side of it.
You won't believe me.
Probably not. But if you can convince me you're telling the truth even a little bit, I'll have you on the show.
Solo segment?
Arnie rubbed his face.
I don't want some point-counterpoint crap.
One-on-one interview, just you and me. He crossed his arms and pretended to think it over for a millisecond.
What do you want to know?
Tell me about the Rusty Eggers tape you claim Dash Maynard has in his possession.
They exist.
How do you know?
I was on the Rusty show. You know this, right?
Right.
Big ratings when I was on. No one talks about that.
Hester sighed. Arnie.
Right, right. So, anyway,
I overheard them, Rusty and Dash. They were talking about the tapes. Dash swore he'd destroy them. So, if Dash destroyed them...
Oh, come on. No one really destroys tapes, Hester. You know that, and Rusty knew it. That's why he was so upset. He knew that Dash would never get rid of them totally. Why would he?
Dash Maynard swears he doesn't have any damaging tapes.
Yeah, well, Dash is a selfish prick, isn't he? He has this big empire. You ever been to his house? It's like something out of Gatsby.
Have you seen the tapes? Hester asked.
Me? No.
So how do you know they exist?
I heard them.
Heard the tapes?
No. I heard Dash and Rusty arguing about them.
What did they say exactly?
It was late at night, see. I was the only one still around. They thought I was gone. That they were alone.
Can I tell you the truth, though?
Yeah, that'd be nice, Arnie. I passed out on the toilet.
Sorry?
Yeah. I was in the studio office, in a toilet stall, sitting down on...
I get the visual, Arnie.
Anyway, he was snorting some coke. Whatever. I don't know. I passed out. When I woke up, the bathroom was totally dark. It was 10 at night. I pulled up my pants. They were still down around my ankles.
Hey, thanks for that detail.
You want the whole story, don't you?
Boxes of briefs.
Huh?
Never mind, Hester said.
You pulled up your pants.
Right.
I pull up my pants. But, like I said, it's totally dark. I mean, pitch black. I feel my way to the latch. You know, the one that opens the stall.
Yes, Arnie. I know all about those latches. We have them in women's bathrooms, too.
Heh. Anyway, it's still dark. I feel my way out of the can. I get into the hallway. I'm worried that maybe they lock the doors at night, like maybe I can't get out, you know what I mean?
Right, go on.
Then I hear voices. Two men.
Let me guess. Rusty and Dash.
Right. And they're arguing. I get closer. I hear Rusty say, you gotta get rid of the tape. You have to promise me.
He's drunk. I can hear it in his voice.
Rusty is usually in control, but he's got that sloppy drunk thing going on. And he keeps saying, you don't get what it could do to us. You should destroy it. You don't want anyone to ever know.
And what did Dash say?
He just said, don't worry, no one would ever know. He'd make sure of it. But Rusty kept insisting. He kept begging Dash to delete it, but then he'd sort of take it back.
What do you mean, take it back?
He knew, Hester. Rusty knew.
Knew what?
That Dash Maynard would never really delete it. Dash sees himself as a serious documentarian or journalist or something, an observer. I wouldn't be surprised if even that conversation was recorded. I'm telling you, there were bugs everywhere, maybe even in that bathroom.
Uh-huh. Hester said. This was sounding more and more like a waste of time.
So what else? That's not enough?
Not really.
They knew I was there.
Did they say something?
No, but 3 days later, I got called in for a surprise urine test. They found drugs in my system. I was fired. Me! Their big ratings draw. Not only that, the test was leaked to the media. You know why, right? It was a plot to discredit me. I was clean.
You just told me you took cocaine.
That was 3 days earlier.
He was getting more and more agitated, shifting in his seat, eyes darting, sweat beads popping up on his forehead. And Hester bet that Arnie Poplin was on something right now.
They needed to discredit me. They needed to get rid of me.
Okay, thanks.
Rusty killed someone.
Hester stopped.
What do you mean? That's what Dash has on him.
Are you saying, Hester began slowly,
that Dash Maynard has a tape of Rusty Eggers committing murder? I can only tell you what I heard.
Which was?
Rusty saying, I didn't mean to kill him. It was an accident.
Those were his exact words?
No, I don't know. That was the meaning. Rusty killed someone. That was their bond. Dash even said that, now that I think of it.
Said what?
That he'd never tell because that was their bond. Something like that. That all the good things that came after were based on that bond.
I'm telling you, Hester, they're killers.
Or Rusty is. Dash has the proof. He has a legal obligation to release that information, doesn't he?
Hester thought about her earlier conversation with Delia, about what she knew and wouldn't reveal despite attorney-client privilege. She glanced over at Rolla. Rolla shrugged, as if to say she didn't know whether to believe him or not.
So can I come on the show? Arnie Poplin said.
I'm free tonight if you want to do it then.
Chapter 29. Gavin Chambers pulled into the 7-Eleven lot in a blue Chevrolet Cruze, alone. Gone for now, at least, were both the driver and the SUV. Discretion, maybe. He slid out of the Chevy wearing a baseball cap and sunglasses, which, Wild thought, was always a dumb disguise because the only people who don that look are trying to disguise themselves. Then again, it was sunny out. Maybe Gavin was just wearing them because they were comfortable. Maybe not everything is a freaking clue.
Why are you at a 7-Eleven? Gavin asked.
The Slurpee isn't reason enough? Gavin sighed.
So what have you learned?
I learned not to move because you had something you needed me to see. At least that's what you told me on the phone. He shook his head.
You remind me of my first wife.
Was she hot, too?
A hot mess.
Wild checked his phone. Do you mind giving me a lift back to the Maynards? We can talk on the way.
Suit yourself.
He hit the unlock button on the remote. As they got in, Gavin dropped the bomb.
We know that there's been a ransom demand.
He started at the car and put it in reverse. Top four possibilities, Wild thought. One, Chambers was completely fishing. That didn't seem likely. Two, what with the panic around the Maynards, Chambers had simply surmised that there must have been a ransom demand. If so, that was a hell of a guess. Three, he did indeed have certain areas of the house bugged. Very possible. Rolla would run a sweep, and he'd know about that soon enough. Four, Gavin had an inside source. Whatever, Wild wasn't going to confirm or deny. At the traffic light, Gavin Chambers turned and stared at him. Wild stared back. For a few moments, neither of them blinked. When the light turned green, someone behind them honked their horn. Gavin shook his head and muttered something under his breath as he pulled out his phone.
You know, I told you that Crash stayed a step ahead of us with the messaging apps, Snapchat, Signal, WhatsApp, whatever.
Yes.
One of my best tech guys found a message received on his ISP last night at 2:07 a.m. via a new app called Communicate Plus. It's encrypted, so the message and sender get automatically deleted a minute after the file is opened. I obviously don't know the details, but somehow, don't ask me how, my tech guy was able to get the tail end of the last message before it was erased.
He handed Wild his phone. The message read, "Of course I forgive you. I know you did that to fool your friends. I'm waiting at the same place right now. So excited." There were three heart emojis at the end. Wild asked the obvious.
Do you know where the message came from or who sent it?
No.
We know it had to be someone else with this app, obviously, but the contact and incoming ISP or whatever gets deleted.
Wild stared at the message. He read it again.
Did someone make a ransom demand? Gavin asked.
You said you already know.
What?
Your exact words were, we know that there's been a ransom demand. If you know, there's no reason to ask me.
Can you stop being a pain in the ass for 5 minutes? Rusty wants to help.
I'm sure he does.
And we both know who wrote that message.
He meant, of course, Naomi. Assuming you're right, Wild said. What do you want to do about it?
Did you check Naomi's house?
I visited the father.
Did you check the whole house? Last time, that's where she was the whole time, right? In the basement.
Wild said nothing. He checked his watch. It was almost 3 p.m., an hour until the deadline. When they approached the gate in front of the Maynard house, Wild said, Thanks for the ride.
You know I'm right, Gavin said.
About?
About everything. You know Naomi is somehow involved in this.
Uh-huh. What else you write about?
He gave him the dagger glare. That you and your sister can't handle this alone.
I'm not calling the shots, Wilde said.
If you tell the Maynards to bring us back in, they'll listen to you.
Something here, something about this whole encounter, was definitely not adding up.
Thanks for the ride, Gavin. Stay in touch.
Rolla met him by the Maynard security gate in a golf cart. I'll drive you up to Hester. He sat beside her as they started up the drive. The grounds were over-manicured. Many would find that beautiful. Wilde did not. Nature paints her canvas. Then you come along and think you can improve it. No. Nature is supposed to be, pardon the wordage, wild. You tame it. You lose what makes it special. After he filled her in, Rolla asked, So, what do you need from me?
The ransom note.
What about it? It asked specifically for the oldest tapes.
Meaning?
The first time Dash Maynard met Rusty Eggers was in D.C. when they were Capitol Hill interns. See if you can find out anything about that time period.
Like what?
Like, I have no idea. Did they room together, hang out? It's a long shot, I admit.
I'll put some researchers on it.
Also, see if you can locate Saul Strauss. He has to be suspect number one here.
Okay, anything else?
Wilde thought about it, and then figured better safe than sorry. I need you to go to Naomi Pine's house when it gets dark.
Rolla looked at him.
Weren't you just there?
I need the place searched.
For?
Crash and Naomi.
Rolla nodded.
On it.
Hester sat alone on a stone bench facing the Manhattan skyline. As Wilde approached, she turned toward him and shaded her eyes. With her other hand, she patted the concrete.
Sit with me.
He did. For a moment, neither of them spoke. They just stared at the skyline over the trees. The sun was at the height where everything, buildings, trees, formations, looked like it had angel halos.
Nice, Hester said.
Yes.
And boring, Hester turned to him. You want to go first?
No.
Didn't think so, Hester said.
Then,
I talked to Arnie Poplin,
she filled him in.
Killed someone, Wilde said when she finished.
That's what he claims he heard.
I assume you weren't the first person he told this to.
I would highly doubt it.
So why hasn't anyone reported it?
Because Arnie Poplin is an attention-seeking, unreliable drug addict with an axe to grind.
Okay.
Journalists would be wary of him under any conditions, but Rusty Eggers rides the refs better than anyone.
Rides the refs? Hester squinted into the sun.
A good friend of mine was a star basketball player in college, a first-round draft pick out of Duke. You a basketball fan at all?
No.
Then you wouldn't know him. Anyway, he's taken me to a few games at Madison Square Garden, college mostly. You know what I always notice?
Wilde shook his head.
The way the coaches rant and scream at the referees. These little men in their suits and ties spend the entire game running up and down the sidelines, having nonstop tantrums like toddlers wanting candy. It's embarrassing to watch. So I asked my friend, the basketball star, what that was all about. And he said, it's an intentional strategy. People by nature want to be liked. Not you, not me, but people in general. So if you scream at the refs every time they blow the whistle on you, legitimate or not, they are more likely to give you a call.
Wilde nodded. And that's what Rusty does with the media.
Exactly. He constantly berates them, and so they cringe and get scared, to keep within the metaphor, to blow the whistle. All politicians do it, of course. Rusty is just better at it.
We should still confront Dash with what Arnie Poplin told you.
Done already.
And?
Hester shrugged. What do you think? Dash denied it. He called it rubbish. He actually used the word, too. Rubbish.
Unfortunate. Your takeaway?
Same as yours.
They're hiding something.
Right.
She patted his leg.
Okay, Bubala. So, what did you learn?
Wilde started by telling her what Bernard Pine said about his ex-wife abusing Naomi. Hester just shook her head.
This world,
Something isn't sitting right with that.
What do you mean?
I don't know, Wild said. I still think we need to talk to Naomi's mother. I told Rola to find her.
Good. What else?
Wild told her about the app communication between Crash and maybe Naomi, as well as Ava's conversations with Naomi about a budding relationship between the two teens.
All signs point to Crash and Naomi being together, Hester said.
Wild said nothing.
So, let's say that's true for the moment, she continued. Let's say these two teens secretly fell for each other and decided to run off.
Okay. Hester shrugged.
How does that turn into a ransom demand?
Wild didn't reply. He checked the time. Less than an hour to the kidnapper's deadline. Should we head inside?
They said to meet at 3:45 p.m. in the library.
They, meaning Dash and Delia Maynard?
Yes.
Any idea what they plan on doing?
They don't want to tell us until then.
Wild looked back at the view. That's not normal.
No, it's not.
They both faced the view now. Hester closed her eyes and let the rays warm her.
How to put this delicately, Hester said.
Wild kept his eyes on the distant skyscrapers. Delicately, he repeated. Not your forte, Hester.
True. So here goes. I was thinking about spending the night at Layla's, but I don't want to sleep over if you are.
Wild couldn't help but smile. I definitely won't be.
Oh.
Doesn't mean it's a good idea to stay, though.
Oh,
Hester said. And then again, oh, really? Wild said nothing.
Can I be nosy?
I assume that's a rhetorical question.
It's been 6 years since we really communicated.
I'm sorry about that, he said.
Me too. And I hope it's not because of David.
David. Saying the name out loud stilled even the trees.
I don't blame you. I never have. You understand that, right?
Wild didn't answer. Is that what you want to be nosy about?
No, Hester said. I won't say you're like a son to me, because that's way over the top. I have 3 sons. They're the only ones like a son to me. But I was there from the beginning, from the first day you came out of the woods.
We were all there, me, Ira, David, of course. You were very good to me, Wild said.
That's not why I'm raising this either, so let me put it bluntly. Those online DNA genealogy tests have become super popular. I even took one a few years ago.
Any surprises?
Not a one. I'm so boring.
But you want to know if I took one, he said.
It's been 6 years, she said, so yes. I want to know if you took one.
I did, very recently, as a matter of fact.
Any surprises?
Not a one. I'm so boring, too.
Seriously?
No parents or siblings. The closest thing was a second cousin.
That's a start, she said.
Wild shook his head. No, Hester, it's not. If you're looking for a missing kid, son, brother, whatever, you'd be on that DNA site. No one is looking for me, ergo no one cares. I don't mean that in a pity-me way, but they left a small child alone in those woods for years.
You don't know that,
Hester said, interrupting.
Wild turned to look at her, but she wouldn't look back at him.
Don't know what, he asked.
How long you were out there?
Not exactly, no.
Could have been days.
Wild didn't know what to make of this. What are you talking about? Your son and I played for years.
Years, Hester made a scoffing sound. Come on. What? You were 2 little boys. You think you could have kept a secret like that for years?
That's what we did.
That's what you think you did. You know how time slows down when you're little? It could have been days, maybe weeks. But years?
I have memories, Hester.
Well, I don't doubt that. But don't you think maybe it could have been just a few days worth? You always say you have no memory of any time before you were in the woods, so maybe, just hear me out, okay? Maybe something happened to you, something so traumatic that you blocked everything from before. Maybe, since you've retained nothing about your life from before this traumatic event, those memories are now magnified, and so what may have been a few days seem like years.
That wasn't what happened. Wild knew that.
Hikers spotted me months and even years earlier.
They said they spotted a little boy. Might have been you, might have been someone else.
But Wilde wasn't buying it. He remembered breaking into homes, lots of them. He remembered traveling miles. He remembered that red banister and those screams.
It doesn't matter, Wilde said. Even if you're right, no one looked for that boy.
That's why you need to find out the truth, to feel whole.
Wilde made a face.
Did you really say to feel whole?
Not my finest moment, I admit, but you know what I mean. You have issues with intimacy and connection, Wilde. That's not a secret. It doesn't take a genius to see it all began with this abandonment. So maybe if you got some understanding of what caused it, of what really happened,
I'd be more normal.
You know what I mean.
It won't change anything.
That's probably so, Hester said.
Then again, there's another reason.